Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Jonathan C. Slatt, award-winning author, regional director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Temperate Asia Program, and we're talking about his new book, Tigers Between Empires, The Improbable Return of Great Cats to the Forests of Russia and China. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
This book really impressed me. It's a report. It's essentially a report of from you of decades-long research by these dedicated people in very remote parts of Russia. And it's written in the sense that you actually feel as the reader that you're there. Talk to me about the research you had to do to get this book done.
Yeah, so the one of the main protagonists of the book, Dale McKell, he's an American biologist who I've known since 1999 or 2000, so for 25 years or so. And he's always been talking about writing a book about his experiences working with Amur or Siberian tigers. After the success of my previous book, The Owls of the Eastern Ice, I sat down with Dale and said, are you ever really going to write this book? Maybe I can help tell the story and get this story out. And he agreed to that. And so I think the reason that there is kind of it's a pretty intimate description of the early years of the project.
Yeah.
And that was because of my access to Dale. I mean, he sat down for at least a dozen interviews. He gave me access to the early letters he wrote home. He's from Massachusetts, early letters to his family in Massachusetts. And just a lot of insights that I think most people wouldn't have access to.
This is a story not just about the specific tigers, the Amur tigers, which people might have previously known as Siberian tigers, but it's also about the intense conservation efforts of the researchers there. I mean, you really finish this book with absolute admiration of the people that put their time and effort into this.
Yeah, I think the key part of the success of sort of preventing these tigers from going extinct was you had these individuals from extremely different backgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
People like Dale, who showed up in Russia speaking no Russian. And his main Russian counterpart, Yevgeny Smirnov, who had been like a mouse expert before kind of graduating to tigers, the shared language they have was of passion for tigers, and so they were able to kind of get past any weird cultural or language barriers and really kind of hone in on what was needed and spend really just dedicating their lives to studying these animals and developing conservation recommendations, which were then converted into government management plans, which helped prevent their extinction.
Let's talk about some general things first. First of all, every single tiger species that's now alive is endangered.
Correct.
Talk to me about it. It's sort of scary to even think about it, but there are several tiger species and several subspecies. What are the causes of them being in this situation?
Yeah, so there's one tiger subspecies, and there were like as early as not too long, about 100 years ago, there were nine subspecies, and we've lost four of those in the wild over the last 100 years, and it's all because of humans. It's habitat destruction. It's killing either due to fear, so eradication campaigns, or for hunting, or for sport. Or for traditional Asian medicines.
Now, there's been a long-term population decline. Let's talk specifically about the Amur tiger. The amazing thing is how quickly that population declined. What were the reasons? I mean, people were just shooting them. They were taking over 100 a year.
Right. Well, yeah. So it was they were kind of okay until the 1860s or so, and that was when Russia and China changed their border. And half of Amur tiger range became Russia, and so suddenly this area that hadn't been very many people before was suddenly flooded with settlers, both from the Russia side and from the Chinese side, trying to firm up that border. And so a lot of habitat destruction, especially on the Chinese side, where some of these forests were being cleared for agriculture, for settlements, as these new individuals moved in. And on the Russia side, there's a lot of hunters, people coming from European Russia, who had the big game hunting attitude toward these big cats. And so you had a lot of aggressive hunting of adults, but at the same time, you also had young animals, so cubs, being removed from the wild alive for zoo and circus markets. And so that just resulted in an absolute tank of the population because, first of all the breeders were being killed, and then the young animals weren't in the wild long enough to then become breeders themselves.
This is another aspect about this story, is that the politics of the countries play a huge role in what's happening to these tigers. Now, at the time that this book takes place, is a changing Russia. Talk to me about that and how that's affecting tigers.
Yeah, and you wouldn't necessarily think, right, in such a remote corner of the world where there's so few humans, that politics has such a direct influence over the fate of something like an Amur tiger. But it really did, and it really it depended on, you know, whether so both sides of the border. So right when on the Russian side, right when it was sort of understood that, okay, these animals are going extinct, the Soviet government started to protect them. There were protected areas, there were bans on the hunting and live capture of cubs. And so that allowed the tigers to slowly start sort of come back. And it's the only tiger subspecies that showed a positive population growth in the 20th century. All the other subspecies were going down. And so you'd really gone from this, you know, about a dozen or two dozen tigers in the 1940s in Russia to 250, 300 by the time the Soviet Union collapsed, which is when the book starts, really, in 1990, 1991. And so all these, you know, decades of conservation gains, all of that was at risk because suddenly hunting was no longer taboo. The borders were now porous. In the 1970s, 1980s, you really couldn't get a tiger skin or a tiger carcass across the border from Russia into China because the borders were tight. Suddenly that was loose. Suddenly people didn't have money. There was hyperinflation. So even people who had savings lost all their savings. And so people turn to the, you know, in times of instability, especially in a remote area like this, people turn to the forest just so they can feed their families. And that's what caused the biggest sudden threat for tigers.
So this whole book is taking place at a really weird time for the tigers and for the people of Russia. Now, let's talk about the area itself. I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but the Primorye?
Yep, Primorye.
Mm-hmm. Primorye. Describe where it is and then what it's like, because it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, so it's a sliver, of the Russian Empire. It's almost like a, I think John Valiant in his book The Tiger describes it as a tiger claw. In my Owl book, I described it as a talon, because it's really this sort of like sharp protrusion that sticks into the belly of Northeast Asia. So on one side, to the east, it's bordered by the Sea of Japan or the East Sea, to the west by China, and to the south by North Korea. So it's right in the heart of Asia. And it's from a natural history point of view, it's pretty unique because it's this area escaped glaciation during the last ice age. And so you have especially plant species that are found nowhere else in the world anymore, because at that latitude, everywhere else, they were under, you know, a lot of ice. But they've persisted here, and you have species assemblages, these mixtures of really unique groups of animals. That's why you have, you know, so tigers and things like leopards are associated with steamy subtropical jungles, and here they are in a temperate forest, alongside boreal species, things we associate with the north, things like moose, things like gray wolves, things like brown bears, and they're all kind of swirled together in this one little mountainous. Mountainous province, and the mountains are kind of like similar to some of the Pacific Coast in the U.S. And sort of the Appalachian Mountains in the east. So those are low rolling hills. In fact, one of Dale McKeld's early letters home to his brother in Massachusetts described it like the White Mountains in New Hampshire.
Now, what's winter like there? Because a lot of the book takes place at that, and it sounds pretty foreboding.
Yeah, well, it's the same. So I live in Minneapolis, and so it's Ternay, where Dale lived over there. It's the same latitude as Minneapolis, so 45 degrees north. So there's four seasons just like here, but it also, you go, you know, along the coast, it's extremely windy, but when you go inland a little bit, you get that continental climate, that deep, deep freeze, and it gets extremely cold. But, you know, minus 30 is normal over there in winter.
And so these guys are starting out doing research. And the story is really the steep curve of their learning how to do this. Now, let's talk about the Siberian Tiger Project. What was that?
Yeah, so that was actually was started around an Idaho campfire. You know, so that the late 1980s, that was a period of geopolitical thaw, right? So, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States were becoming friendlier. They were looking for new ways to collaborate and explore. So there were all these sort of, you know, partnerships between Western and Soviet enterprises. And as part of one of these exchanges, that there were these Soviet scientists that were touring some national parks and just sort of protected areas in the American West. And as they happened to be in Idaho, where there's a big cat researcher named Morris Hornocker, who very experienced. He's the first person to put a radio collar on cougars. He'd worked with jaguars in South America, leopards in Africa. And so some of these Soviet scientists were lamenting that, like, oh, you know, tigers, they're impossible to study. Like, we can track them in winter, but as soon as the snow melts, their tracks disappear. We have no idea where they are or what they're doing. And Morris was the perfect person to hear this complaint from the Soviets, because he had the answer, which was using his own expertise with big cats. And so that's how this project was born. So Morris and one of his former graduate students named Howard Quigley would come over to Russia, help the Soviets capture tigers, put on collars, radio VHF collars, so that they could track these animals year-round. And it wasn't conceived as a conservation project, right? Because at the time, you know, tigers are still recovering. It was really just to understand, you know, how are tigers sort of recolonizing these lands where they've been absent for decades.
First of all, even as you write about in the book, even seeing a tiger up until that point could be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I mean, they're incredibly difficult to find, to see, and to observe. So they decide that one of the things is they've got to capture tigers, first of all, to put radio collars on them. And they had to figure out how to do that. Their first idea was to build these huge boxes. And describe to me that, because that didn't work out at all, by the way. Spoiler alert. But talk to me about these boxes. I mean, there are these and they're doing all this in incredibly difficult terrain.
They had so much going against them. And so, like, you talk about, you know, the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So a single male resident tiger has a home range of up to 540 square miles. So somewhere in this 540-square-mile area, there's one animal. There's one tiger. And so, what they decided to do is, right, what you said, is they built these boxes. Think of, like, a live trap you put in your attic for a squirrel or something.
But really big. But really big.
And they put dogs in there.
Live dogs.
A live dog, under the assumption, because wolves and tigers are natural enemies. And so the assumption was that if a tiger's walking by, he can't help himself. He'll go in there and he'll try to kill that wolf, or, you know, in this case, the dog. As it turns out, tigers are remarkably suspicious of giant boxes.
Well, it's this huge, odd box in the middle of a forest.
Exactly.
And most animals would go, I have no idea what's going there. I'm going to pass it by. And that's what happened.
So, of course, it didn't work. All the dogs were released back to the village.
Slow down a minute, because first of all, they had to keep feeding the dogs. So
they
had to go out all the time, check on the dogs, make sure they're okay and still alive. And by the way, one of them was later, like, luckily adopted.
So every day, as part of Dale's job, he would take a frozen herring down to Red. Red was one of his dogs that he had to sort of check in the box. And the poor dog, he was so happy because the dog didn't have a whole lot going on. It was just sort of sitting in a box all the time. And so he'd get really excited every time Dale would come up and give him this fish, and then sort of the tail would start wagging slower as Dale.
Dale definitely felt bad for the dog.
Oh yeah, right. So right, and so eventually, like once everyone acknowledged that these giant boxes were a failure, Dale did end up adopting Red and taking them.
Now away. I think, and if I remember right, the tiger was never going to be able to get to the dog, right?
Correct. Yeah, there was a barrier inside, so the idea was that it would go in and then
get captured.
You know, the trap would close behind it. Correct.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Jonathan C. Slatt, award-winning author, regional director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Temperate Asia Program. And we're talking about his new book, Tigers Between Empires, The Improbable Return of Great Cats to the Forests of Russia and China. So, next stage, snares. Describe that for a bit. Like, they're setting out snares.
Yeah. So
how did they even figure out where to put the snare?
Right. So yeah. So when Morris and Howard Quigley, who I mentioned earlier, and Howard's wife Kathy, who was a wildlife vet, and Dale, they were the first four Americans to go over. Almost as an afterthought, Morris thought to bring some snares, just in case. And snares have been used since I think the 1960s in North America as a safe way to capture large carnivores, things like cougars and bears. Once they realized that the box traps were simply not working, then they started thinking about the snares. And so the first plan was to put snares, so to track a tiger in the snow, so they're doing their early captures in winter, track a tiger through the snow till they find something that it killed, a boar or a deer, and then put snares in strategic locations around that kill, so when a tiger came back to feed, it would then get trapped.
The amazing thing is, you sort of run over quickly. They find a place where they've made a kill. That in itself was a major deal, just to find that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I feel like, and that's why the book is 400 plus pages. It's really easy to kind of summarize what this was, but the day to day.
Oh my God.
Not only are they just constantly out, walking through the forest, just trying to find some evidence of a tiger in this again, 540 square kilometer area, but they were having trouble feeding themselves because around them society was collapsing. The stores were bare. There were gas rations, so it wasn't like they had a comfortable place to go home to at the end of the day.
Oh no, they were in a very tiny village, and the nearest Vladivostok was how many miles away to the north? I mean, it was really the nearest city of any worth is hugely far away.
Right. Yeah. And so, right. So the closest gas station was about 60 kilometers away, and they would get a ration of, I don't know it in gallons, it was in liters, 20 liters was what they could get.
Oh my
and it
God.
Took something like 15 liters to get there and back. So they would only end up with a net of 5 liters of fuel each time they went to the gas station. It was crazy.
It's an amazing story. Now, they finally find a place to set up their snares. And then they were thinking about snaring a tiger. And they're going to have to shoot a dart into it to sedate it. Now, the first thing is there were several drugs that they had to use in order to sedate the tiger. And nobody was quite sure about how much it would take, right?
Right. So, like, every dosage, it always depends on, the size of an animal. It depends on the state of the animal. So if an animal is hyper agitated, the drugs might not work as well. There's a lot of guesswork. But Howard Quigley, who was leading the darting process for the first capture, did have experience with jaguars, so he had some sense of dosage for a tiger.
Still, there are descriptions of when they snare a tiger that are frightening, because they would try to get into position to dart it. And this tiger would sort of make a rush at them as far as he could within the snare. And it sounded really dicey.
Right. And no one had done this before, right? Like, no one had snared a tiger, certainly not in Russia. And, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't know how the animal would respond to the cold, how the animal Whether would the snares close properly in the deep cold, or would it be loose? And then on one of these charges, when the tiger's kind of coming at Dale, is it going to get loose? Is it going to just keep coming? So yeah, a lot of certainly a high tension situation.
And needless to say, a snared tiger is a very pissed off tiger.
Yeah, their first reaction always seems to be escape. They'll lunge away as best they can, and they'll try that a few times, and eventually decide, all right, that's it. I'm going after my aggressor, and then they'll start up, come at whoever's approaching them.
Now, one of the first things that they snared was not a tiger. It was a bear.
Yes, early within the first year, they did catch a bear accidentally in their trap. Yes,
and that didn't go well at all.
It didn't go well, and it was so. Again, they were new to all of this, and in winter when they were first trying to catch tigers, bears are in hibernation, right? They're in their den, so there wasn't a. Bears weren't really on their radar, and as capture attempts bled into spring, and as the snow melted, bears start showing up, and yeah, they got a bear, and a lot went wrong with that.
well, you need to read the book to figure that out. Now, as they're doing this, and I was amazed at this, there was still poaching going on while the project was going on.
Yeah, and there's few. The roads that sort of cut through tiger habitat, they're lonely, they're isolated. There's almost no law enforcement presence because law enforcement also needed gas for their vehicles, which was also being rationed. There's a lot of opportunities for people to poach, not just tigers, but also tiger prey, things like deer and boar. Yep.
But the amazing thing is, and also wasn't a tiger cub hit by a car too?
There was a tiger cut by a truck.
The whole story is really incredible. These poor guys out in the middle of nowhere trying to help these tigers and doing everything they can. And it's a massive effort. And they had to deal with so many things. I mean, there are new nearby logging operations still. There was tick-borne encephalitis. I mean, God, it's amazing how dedicated these people were. And it was also a unique project where Russian scientists and American scientists worked really close together.
Yeah, the early 1990s, it really was. It was a great time to be involved in any really collaboration between the Russians and the Americans, because there was this sense of optimism. And, all these things that had held us back, all these barriers are now gone. And what can we do together? And that really was the vibe in that part of the country during the 1990s. It was nice.
How did they get funding?
Well, eventually, so it took a long time. So Morris Hornocker started out fundraising for the project just to get it off the ground, and he ran into so much opposition that he wasn't expecting in the United States. Other tiger researchers said, you never catch them. They're tigers in Russia are too cryptic. The home ranges are too large. You'll never catch them. So it was difficult to fundraise for. National Geographic eventually gave them $100,000 seed funding, which was really enough for the first year to get the project off the ground. But they had to show proof of concept. They had to demonstrate that they could catch tigers. They could collar tigers. They could track tigers in a meaningful way that would give them information about tiger ecology. And they were able to do that within the first year. And so once they showed they could do it, then funding opened up from other sources as well.
It's amazing. Once they get the radio collars on them and they're able to track them, even by helicopter, it's amazing what they learned about tigers and their behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the neatest things that they learned, well, at least from my perspective, was a concept called a home range inheritance, where a mother gives birth to a couple cubs. Males, once they reach the normal dispersal age of about a year and a half, they just sort of take off. They go hundreds of miles to find their own territories. Females tend to be, if the mother is in a good territory with good prey numbers and good habitat, she might carve off some of her own home range and, you know, bequeath it to her daughter. So it's, you know, home range inheritance, so giving
wow.
Territory to their daughter. And the benefit of that, of course, is that this is where that tigress, the young tigress, it's where she grew up, right? She knows the best spot to lay an ambush for deer walking by. She knows where there are humans, so she knows which areas to avoid. So it's a safer place for her to establish her own territory than these poor males who are really kind of just like shooting off into darkness, you know, unsure of what they're going to stumble upon next. And so the young females, they live longer. They have higher survival than young males, I think, because of this.
Now, we're almost completely out of time, but I want to mention, and people are going to need to read the book to find out what happens, but snares are banned. And so they're left with, okay, our main way of catching tigers is now banned. What are we going to do? But they do figure out something. And that's the book finishes up on that. This is an amazing book about an amazing place. And it really is a success story. I mean, you must have been heartened by this story, even though it was a lot of work.
Yeah, it is. It is a true conservation success story. But one thing, I don't want folks to come away from reading the book to thinking that, all right, great, you know, the problem of more tiger conservation.
Oh no! Oh no! Oh no! You don't. If you read the book, you don't come out with that.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah, because it is. It's a constant, you know, constant
right.
vigilance is needed to kind of, you know, they're not extinct now, and I think there's a future for them. We just need to stay sharp.
It's slow. And they need a lot of help still. My returning guest tonight is Jonathan C. Slatt, award-winning author, regional director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Temperate Asia Program. And we're talking about his new book. It is a great story and thrilling too in a lot of parts. Tigers Between Empires, The Improbable Return of Great Cats to the Forests of Russia and China. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.